Hello, kids, and welcome once again to Common Sense here on CFUR. I'm your host, Doug Strachan, and welcome to the program. Lots to talk about. The next time I talk to you, President-elect Barack Obama will be, in fact, President of the United States. Isn't that amazing? I often wonder, you know, what Martin Luther King would think at this rather momentous occasion. To say it's a dream come true, I think, speaks the obvious. Unfortunately, it wasn't in Martin Luther King's lifetime. You think about the U.S. On Monday, they'll celebrate Luther King's birthday, and on Tuesday, they'll have the inauguration of the first Afro-American. It's history-making, it really is. So more about that later. I've got a few things to discuss with you. Now, do you know, in spite of what you and your Uncle Don says, I think the U.S. exhibits many more details of democracy, or ideals of democracy, than Canada does. Over the last week, I've been watching these on CNN, the Senate confirmation hearings of Hillary Clinton, as well as several others who are striving to be cabinet ministers in Barack's new government. And, of course, Hillary is going for Secretary of State. Now, granted, you know, this is a love-in, as most of the committee is made up of like-minded Democrats. But that doesn't diminish the significance of the process. Now, there's Hillary, and there's several others, like I say, who are going for the various positions and have to be voted in by the various Senate committees for their positions. Now, you see, what happens is the following. The president-elect suggests a nominee for a certain position, and the committee has to agree or disagree with the appointment. Once confirmed, they're in. Simple as that. But you know, kids, I'll tell you, you contrast that with the Canadian system, and maybe you can see my point about the Americans being more democratic than us Canadians. Before Christmas, Stephen Harper appointed 18 individuals to the Senate. Done deal. No confirmation. The Prime Minister's choice, and in they go. What the hell, you know, under our system, Stephen Harper could elect a Cocker Spaniel for Minister of Defense. Amazing, isn't it? I like the American system for obvious reasons. I recall George Bush, senior nominee of the Supreme Court of the U.S., won Clarence Thomas. This is back about 83 or 84. Now, he underwent the same scrutiny as Hillary, but with some complications. A young staffer by the name of Anita Hill alleged some sexual impropriety during Thomas's tenure on the appellate court. Now, as it turned out, her allegations were never proven, and Thomas was eventually granted the nomination, and now he sits as one of the 9 Chief Justices of the Supreme Court of the United States. My point is what a wonderful example of democracy in action this is, when you have not just the president, but a committee confirming a cabinet appointment or a Supreme Court appointment. I think that's great. I think that's democracy in action. Anyway, the inauguration is January 20th, and the world will be watching. The world. Hey, listen, have you heard? There'll be approximately 2 million people along the parade route. He's going to walk it. He and Michelle, his wife, and their 2 kids. Now, apparently, even Osama bin Laden's been watching. Yeah, he apparently sent a message to Obama suggesting he pull his troops out of Afghanistan and Iraq or suffer the, quote, full weight of the Arab nations and Allah on his almighty head. That came from Osama bin Laden, allegedly. You know, we don't know whether these are accurate or not, but that was a text message sent by Osama from far in the hills near Bora Bora on the border of Afghanistan and Pakistan. Do you know why there are no trees in Afghanistan? Osama's been logging. 2, 3, 4, 5. Okay. Just throw in a bit of humor, kids. You know, got to keep the show light. Right. Anyway, have you ever seen a more anticipated event than Barack's nomination and inauguration? Boy, some political experts are suggesting that his inauguration rivals that of FDR back in 1940. Talk about who has the weight of the world on his shoulders. He is the man. But typical of him, and God bless him, you know, he's going to spend a few hours next week going to a shelter to allow his girls to select a puppy from a Washington shelter. How cool is that? You know, you get inaugurated as president of the United States, 44th president, on Tuesday. I believe the day is Friday. He's taking his girls to an animal shelter to select a puppy. Now, I've been involved with the SPCA for a number of years. You know, I think this sets a wonderful example. It really does. Because it appears what Barack does, people follow. So to think he will choose not from a breeder, but from a shelter in Washington, I think speaks volumes. And hopefully that'll benefit the SPCA, not only in the United States, but in Canada, and specifically here in Prince George. Here's open. On Sunday, he's teamed up with some White House reps for a 4-on-4 basketball game against the press. You go, Barack. Can you imagine him saying, "Look, I'll consult you regarding the ongoing conflict in Gaza right after I hit this 3-pointer. It just brings a certain humanity to the role of president. I think it's wonderful. Anyway, back to Canada for a moment. Canada seems so boring, doesn't it? Compared to what's happening in the U.S. I note that Liberal leader Michael Ignatieff has virtually put the kibosh on this idiotic coalition with a few Democrats and the separatists. You get that? A few Democrats? It's one of my lines. So Michael is saying, "Hey, who needs you guys? The Liberal Party can stand on its own." This guy's pretty smart, you know, irrespective of the fact he's got a PhD from Harvard. Hey, speaking of idiots, and I note with interest that that poor excuse for a union leader, Sid Ryan, president of QP, has demanded that all Canadian universities deny access to visiting Jewish university professors to the hallowed halls of academia unless they renounce their government's involvement in the ongoing Gaza conflict. You got that? And I say that because I understand some QP members are here on campus, and I'd like to remind them that if that's the case, I would urge you to rid yourself of your esteemed president as soon as you can, or the next time you have a chance to vote. Okay? Sid Ryan was on CBC saying just that no academic institution should allow any visiting Jewish professors on campus unless they publicly renounce Israel's involvement in the ongoing conflict in Gaza. Which begs the question, who in the hell does this jerk-off think he is? There you go, a president of a union telling a university what to do, who they can hire. Sid Ryan, as I say, is an idiot, and he has proved several times over the past few years. He suggested, by the way, this is a guy that suggested that Concordia University refuse former Prime Minister of Israel Benjamin Netanyahu a speaking engagement regarding the Middle East. True to form, some students followed like sheep, broke windows, tipped over cars, and generally made it so uncomfortable that the former PM agreed to cancel his speaking engagement at Concordia. You know, it begs the question, doesn't it, kids? Where was Sid Ryan when the IRA was killing innocent civilians in Ireland? Where was Sid Ryan when the majority of Hutus killed over 800,000 Tutsis in Rwanda? Where was Sid Ryan when the Mujahideen are killing innocents in Darfur? Remember Darfur and the Sudan? It's still going on. Does Sid Ryan have an opinion on this? Not. His silence is deafening. You know, here you have a union leader bitching about a democracy, simple desire for self-determination in the Middle East, notably Israel. A country that allows collective bargaining for its unionized employees, a country that allows its unions to strike, a country that allows strikes under its constitution. It goes further. That's Israel, Sid, a country with a constitution that a union leader should be proud of, you would think. Maybe Sid Baby should look at workers' rights in Gaza, Egypt, or any of those other backward Arab countries that haven't graduated to granting basic human rights. Do you know what motivates this guy, I think? It's jealousy. He can't figure out how a little country like Israel could be so successful. How indeed can the Jewish people around the world be the leaders of industry, arts, and commerce? It's a question for which I certainly have no answer. It's such an enigma that our illustrious chief of the Assembly of First Nations, Phil Fontaine, traveled a couple of years ago to Israel to figure out what makes kibbutzes work. It's long been argued that a kibbutz is similar to our reserves, with a hell of a lot better outcomes for its residents without the tit of government funding to support it. You know, when the good chief came home, he may have had some answers, but he wasn't sharing them. You know, I started to think maybe eugenics is a valid science, but any discussion of that subject can lead to a charge of racism, so I won't go there. But it begs the question, doesn't it? Anyway, the CRTC may be listening, so I got to be careful. But you know, if this is the case, I know a lot of you naysayers say that Israel exists only because of military involvement of the Americans. We know that America has supported Israel for a number of years. But if those of you who believe that, perhaps you can explain to me why Israel was successful in the 1948 war with five of its Arab neighbors. You know, Army Chief of Staff at the time, Moshe Dayan, wrote a book about that war, which is now required reading for all Russian Army and Navy officers. True. Anyway, I don't want to go on about the Middle East. I talked about it last week. There'll be more to talk about as there is a vote coming where there might be a ceasefire between Hamas and Israel, subject to UN sanction. Whether that'll happen, who knows? Hamas, as I told you last week, will not agree to anything unless Israel pulls out completely and opens up its borders. It's funny, isn't it? Hamas does not make the same urgent request or demand of Egypt to its south. But I guess that's part of the Arab Brotherhood, right? Yeah, go figure. Let's go back to Barak. That's a happy story. You know, it's such a good news story, but not without controversy. Before he gets elected, kids, or before he gets inaugurated, pardon me, you may know that Congress has released half of the $700 billion bailout without significant results. Now Barak wants the remainder released, and the Senate subcommittee, being sensitive to electors, is asking some pretty tough questions. We've seen the first $350 billion released with not a lot of benefit. Dow Jones is still down. The TSX is still down. NASDAQ is still flat. Question, where did the first $350 billion go? But you know, there are two sides to that story, too. Let's look at it from a banker's point of view. I phoned a banker, actually, last week, a friend of mine, and he asked me the following question. Do you really want to lend money to an individual or company whose creditworthiness is somewhat suspect? That's a problem with the bailouts, you know. Sure, lend the money, but to whom? Like, would you really want to grant a loan to Nortel Networks? Nortel, as you know, was a darling of the phone industry, of the high-tech industry. Back in 2000, its shares were trading for $120 a share. Now you can buy some Nortel shares for 8 cents a share. So, like everything else, you know, there's two sides, right? Sure, we want to release and ease credit. But from a banker's perspective, to whom do you release the credit and the money to? Are they viable? There's not a lot of viable businesses out there, according to my banker friend. And anyway, giving money to unworthy debtors caused this financial morass in the first place. So there you go, halfway through. Reminder, you're listening to Common Sense here on CFUR. I'm your host, Doug Strachan. Thank you for tuning us in. All right, let's bounce around from topic to topic. So next month, the Ministry of Education is delivering to each school with grades 4 to 7 the foundation skills assessment tests. You might have heard about this. Now, you've probably heard about these controversial little gems. They're basically tests to indicate how students are managing and understanding the data given, the curriculum, right? Hey, it's no big whoop. Unless you talk to a member of the BCTF who have refused to mark the assignments. Their concerns are rather specious at best. I checked with some retired teachers who tell me that these tests have been mandated by the ministry for years, and they pay you time and a half to go and mark them down in Vancouver, okay? That's no big deal. They tell me that the BCTF's problem is that the Fraser Institute, the nemesis of the union, is using these marks to grade schools. Got it? So what? You know, I as a parent would like to know which schools are performing well and which ones aren't. I also want to know how my kid's doing vis-a-vis other kids. Besides, the results are not contained in your final grade, so it's rather interesting, isn't it? No problem from the BCTF until the Fraser Institute got involved. Isn't that interesting? My brother was a teacher for College Heights and other schools, and he said, we did them for years. No objection. As a matter of fact, he tells me that some of the teachers at the three schools in which he taught actually wanted to go and mark the exams because they were paid time and a half by the ministry. But as soon as the Fraser Institute started grading the schools, then the BCTF gets there in a knot. No problem. And to be fair to the Fraser Institute, I should also tell you that they don't take a static approach to this. One school, which I probably should not mention on this program, has raised its standards. It was one of the bottom of the list a few years ago, and now it's come up five notches. So it's not a static approach, kids. What it shows you one year will show you either an increase or a decrease the following year. And I, as a parent, quite frankly, want to know that. So again, it's been going on for approximately 15 years without a peep. Nothing should change. All right, back to Obama. It is such a good news story, I can't leave it. Did you hear that the first country he will visit after his inauguration is Canada? Well, that's a feather in our cap. I think it's a credit to the respect held for both countries and a recognition that we are the U.S.'s biggest trading partner. Do you know that over $1.5 billion worth of goods is crossed over the 49th parallel every day? Now, hang on, not so fast, because I should also tell you that during the campaign, Barack suggested a reopening at NAFTA. It's the old line, kids, you know, be careful what you wish for. It might come true. Now, all the lefties out there would love to renegotiate NAFTA, but bear in mind that if it is, in fact, Barack who does it, he's negotiating from the advantage of the U.S., not Canada. Now, I'll have more to talk about this problem, potential problem, next week, because if, in fact, Barack does this, the suggestion is, and the history of Democrats show us, that they tend to be more isolationist, more protective than the Republican counterparts, which means that the chances of tariffs on the 49th parallel are increased under Barack, only from a historical point of view. You know, he said on his campaign trail that he will do everything to help save the jobs of the manufacturing belt. Manufacturing belt includes states like Michigan, Pennsylvania, Ohio, and all those states voted very heavily for Barack Obama back in November. So, remember George Bush when he said back in 2004, I got some political capital, kids, and I'm going to spend it. Well, as of January 20th, Barack Obama is going to say the same thing. I got some political capital, I'm going to spend it, but here's where I should spend it. And notably, he might want to spend it in the manufacturing sector of the United States. That being the case, you must remember that it is Michigan, Ohio, and those other manufacturing areas that directly compete with Canada's manufacturing sector. You see where I'm going with this? And like I say, I'll have more details on it next week. But heaven help us if Barack Obama recommends a tariff on Canadian exports into the U.S. If he did, and I'll give you one example. If he did that with automotive parts, that would pretty well kill the automobile industry as we know it. It would make virtual ghost towns of Windsor, Oakville, Oshawa, that southern belt of Ontario where we build all our cars. Because bear in mind, it's just not the big three in the States. There are plants in the southern part of the States that are owned by Honda, Toyota, Kia, Subaru. So it would appear to me that the U.S. could, in fact, maintain their own automobile industry. Granted, chances are prices might increase, but if you were to do that, it would be at the expense of the Canadian automobile industry and its parts manufacturer. Already we see Magna, the big parts manufacturer, laying off about 500 people in southern Ontario, and according to the owner, more to come about April or May, subject to what Brock's going to do. Okay, so while I revel in the man's candidacy and his success, I wonder, when it comes to reopening NAFTA, well, again, kids, stick around. It may not be all happiness, especially north of the 49th parallel. Okay, let me check, see what else I got for you. Hang on, it's worth it. If you're good kids, I'll tell you a joke at the end of the show. Anyway, I'll lighten up for the last few minutes. I was watching PBS the other day, Public Broadcasting System, Channel 9 to us here, and it was cute. They were talking about comedy on radio and television. Now, of course, it started with radio, but then they talked about and showed us some funny clips about comedy on the early days of TV with such shows as Burns and Allen, Ozzie and Harriet, shows that you kids would not know about, but your parents and grandparents might, okay? But one of the more prophetic statements regarding Obama came from a gentleman by the name of Archie Bunker. Back in the 70s, there was a program called All in the Family, and it ran for 7 years. It was the number one rated program on television for about 5.5 years. And what it basically did was catch the tenor of the times. Back in the 70s, as you might recall, or might know if you've been reading about this sort of stuff, that there was a real clash of generations. A generation gap was the phrase used. And nothing epitomized the generation gap more than the ongoing arguments between Archie Bunker and his son-in-law, Michael Stivic, a.k.a. the Meathead. Anyway, I recall watching it. It was a fabulous show, only because, again, it was a barometer of the times. It did more than any other program to show what the generation gap was all about. Anyway, while watching this program last Tuesday, a rather prophetic statement was made by Archie, who again was the ultimate bigot, granted. Anyway, he said, arguing with his son-in-law, Meathead, he said, and I quote, "You'd finish university and get a job when the U.S. of A. nominates a black president." Like I say, kids, how emphatic, how prophetic. And that was done in 1977. And here we are, 32 years later, with the impossibility happening. You just got to rejoice. Again, on Tuesday, there'll be approximately 2 million people on the parade route who will join in the celebration. There are 10 venues that Brock and his wife Michelle will attend. Well, you talk about tired feet. Ouch. And what faces him come Wednesday morning? How about two world wars? Not world wars, but wars. An economy in free fall, a dysfunctional education system and healthcare system, and an energy crisis, none of his making. Thanks a lot, George W. But true to his form, along with his busy schedule, there's time for a pickup basketball game and a visit to the local animal shelter to select a puppy for his two kids. Is this guy human or what? Can you dig it? Man, I sure can. All right, I'll leave you with a couple of notes. You might have heard the other day there was a rather tragic or potentially tragic accident when a A350 jet crashed into the Hudson River. Fortunately, due to the skill of the pilot All 156 people survived. Apparently what happened when it took off from LaGuardia Airport in New York, heading for North Carolina, it ran into a flock of geese. And geese getting into a jet engine can cause this sort of tragedy, potential tragedy. Now, I spoke just recently with a spokesman for the geese who claimed it was not their fault. After all, they honked. Sorry. Oh, that's one of mine. I think it's original. Now, I would not make light of this if there was a loss of life, but there was not. So just thought I'd share that with you. Okay. So there you have the program for the week. I'd like to thank you for listening to Common Sense. And I'll leave you with one fast Stephen Wright line. You know, all my weird friends want to tune in about 25 after 12 to catch one. So all my weird, goofy friends, here you go. My brother and I were often kept in a closet for 5 minutes by my dad. We had to stand straight and look straight ahead and say nothing. He called it elevator practice. So one day I'm in an elevator and I turn to the guy beside me and I said, "Did your dad make you do this too?" And he said, "What the hell are you talking about?" Stephen Wright. What happens if you get scared to death? Oh, I see, I blew it. What happens if you get scared half to death twice? Think about that for the weekend. There you go, kids. That is our program, Common Sense, for the week. Trust you enjoyed the show. If you shared your time with me, I thank you for that. And if you did, I consider my time well spent. Till I'm talking to you next week, I'm Doug Strachan. It's been a pleasure.